ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 12th of February. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. After days of speculation, Liberal frontbencher Angus Taylor has quit Shadow Cabinet, leaving the party in disarray. While he hasn't called for a spill motion, that's expected to come later today, with the party room meeting likely this afternoon or tomorrow. Mr. Taylor's supporters say he has the numbers to win a challenge, but opposition leader Susan Lee won't let go without a fight. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska has more.
I've tendered my resignation as a member of the Shadow Cabinet. Happy to take a couple.
After months of speculation, Angus Taylor finally showed his hand.
I don't believe Susan Lee is in a position to be able to lead the party as it needs to be led from here.
Waiting until Susan Lee had wrapped up a meeting with the Israeli president to declare no confidence in her leadership, citing successive opinion polls that place the coalition in dire straits.
We need strong leadership, clear direction, and a relentless and courageous focus on our values.
Having stopped short of declaring he'll challenge for the top job, Angus Taylor is hoping to pressure Susan Lee to agree to spill the leadership, with further frontbench resignations from his supporters expected today, and possibly a party room meeting where more than one challenger could be declared.
There's two parts to any process like this. There's whether there's a vote to spill the leadership, and then there's a vote about the way forward.
Moderate Tim Wilson says numbers in the party room are tight. Liberal MP Ben Small says Mr. Taylor has his support.
You read the tea leaves very well there.
Senator Alex Antic too.
I voted for Angus the first time round. I think Angus is an exceptionally capable person.
And former National turned Liberal Jacinta Numpa-Jimpa Price.
I believe Angus will have what it takes to demonstrate that we are the alternative government.
While centrist Dean Smith has declared his support for Susan Lee.
As a member of the Shadow Ministry, I do support the leader, and I'm someone who voted for Susan at the last ballot.
Tim Wilson says the Federal Liberal Party's first ever female leader has been treated unfairly.
I've seen her consistently show a steely resolve despite National Party separations, terrorist attacks, an unrelenting assault by Anthony Albanese and his bully boys on the front bench.
A sentiment echoed by fellow moderate Melissa Price.
Would you put your hand up?
Not after the way Susan's been treated, no way.
One of Ms. Lee's early detractors, Andrew Hastie, says he won't reconsider a tilt for the top job.
I made a decision a couple of weeks ago based on an informed judgment and counsel from my colleagues, and I'm sticking to it.
Fellow Conservative John O'Dunham offered this advice to his colleagues.
What we need to focus on is not just who sits in the big chair at the end of the table, but indeed what it is we as a party stand for and becoming relevant for voters across the country.
Liberal Senator Jonathan Dunham ending Sarah Tomevska's report. Crime and corruption experts have backed findings of criminal activity within the construction branch of the CFMEU in Victoria. Geoffrey Watson, SC, wrote the report, which he yesterday discussed at a Queensland Commission of Inquiry investigating the union. One of his most startling conclusions is criminal bikie gangs turned major construction sites in Victoria into so-called drug distribution centres. David Sparks has more.
Drug dealing, violence and sexual exploitation all feature in Geoffrey Watson's astonishing report on the construction branch of the Victorian CFMEU, focusing on the period from 2010 to 2024. While shocking, it's familiar territory for former New South Wales detective turned gang crime writer Duncan McNabb.
Oh, they're absolutely confronting findings, and it reinforces what some of us have been saying for years, that outlaw motorcycle gangs, the larger ones, particularly the Hells Angels, the Bandidos, Mongols, Rebels, Comancheros, have tentacles deep into Australia.
A redacted report by Geoffrey Watson SC has been released by Queensland's Commission of Inquiry into the CFMEU. He's told the inquiry his informants in Victoria feared violence.
I think I gave the example in there of particular informants who told me something which is dynamite. I flew down to Melbourne just to meet them. And when I got there, they told me, we can't do it. it's scary. There are things set on fire. There are people who are hurt.
One explosive finding was that outlaw motorcycle gangs had converted large state government project construction sites into drug distribution centres, with rival gangs fighting for control. Duncan McNabb again.
Look, quite frankly, it wouldn't surprise me. Any opportunity to make a large amount of money out of selling drugs to people is something that they wouldn't pass up.
Amid allegations of political pressure over embarrassing findings, the CFMEU's federal government-appointed administrator, Mark Irving, has defended his instruction that part of Geoffrey Watson's report be redacted, saying the allegations haven't been examined in court and will be referred to police. Geoffrey Watson says he believes the union's actions went unchecked because the Victorian government was intimidated by the threat of industrial action. That theory is echoed by Anthony Wheely, chair of the Centre for Public Integrity.
I happen to agree with it because you have to ask yourself, what other reason could there be? It is fear of the power wielded by this union that undoubtedly has led the government into doing nothing. This is a powerful union. There are these projects, multi-million dollar projects, that would be threatened if the union pulled up stumps or deliberately delayed them. That's clearly, I think, what is the root cause of this inaction.
Victorian Attorney General Sonia Kilkenny did not comment directly on the report, but she says the government has acted swiftly to eradicate corruption in the construction industry. Geoffrey Watson also acknowledges that Victorian police are now taking much stronger action to tackle the problem.
David Sparks with that report. 18 years ago, a national promise was made to reduce the number of Indigenous Australians dying early, not finishing school, and living without employment within a generation. Today, the Prime Minister will deliver the annual Closing the Gap report card, a national agreement that was updated 5 years ago to bring on board state and territory governments and Indigenous leaders. Despite the new deadline being just 5 years away, four of the 19 targets are not on track to be met. For more on this, the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Malindiri McCarthy. Minister, good morning and thanks for joining us on AM.
Good morning, Isabel, and good morning to your listeners.
Now, we'll take a look at some of the Closing the Gap targets that are not on track. But before we do that, can we take a look at where we are seeing improvements? Often we know this improvement is really led by the hard work of Indigenous communities and Indigenous leaders.
We certainly can see success in terms of what we're trying to do across our lands and the seas in terms of First Nations people, whether it's through Native Title or Aboriginal land rights. There's a very strong return in that, and that's why the jobs program has been important to roll out across remote and regional Australia. That was a huge challenge, and trying to elevate the areas of health where we've needed to do that through improving the standard of living, improving the ability to have a home, a roof over your head. So very basic standards in that, and certainly that goes along with schooling, and that's really the push we've got to do this year, is to ensure that our kids get to school, but not only get to school, complete it.
Look, as you say, the government has dedicated hundreds of millions to a new remote jobs plan, dozens of millions for upgrades to community-controlled health organisations, further subsidies for remote food stores, more money for crisis accommodation and birthing on country programs. I mean, that's a lot of investment. So why is it that still, when we look at these Closing the Gap targets, we only see four of 19 that are on track after we've been trying to close these gaps now for close to 18 years?
This particular agreement is actually only 5 years old, Isabella, and I think it's important for people to understand. This agreement was signed in 2020, the National Agreement on Closing the Gap. It was actually done under Ken White as the then Minister for Indigenous Australians. So we are halfway through that, and we see this expiring in 2031. So we have another 5 years to really get to the end of this and hopefully close that gap. And that is our aim, as the Prime Minister will say today in the House. We are not going to fail in this. We are absolutely determined at the Commonwealth level to do that.
Probably important to say that Australia has been looking at a closing the gap plan since 2008 under Kevin Rudd. So it has been going on for a long time. But as you say, this newer agreement signed about 10 years ago, only 5 years left to meet those targets. And we know a lot of them are not on track. One of the toughest targets to close looks like one of those ones around justice, particularly youth incarceration levels.
That's right.
Do you feel frustrated, you know, in your home state of the Northern Territory when you see the governments there winding back Royal Commission recommendations around ways to reduce Indigenous imprisonment rates, bringing back things like spit hoods, restrainment chairs, and also reducing the age of criminal responsibility, things that we know put more Indigenous kids into prison?
There are certainly many, many moments of frustration. There is no doubt about that. Not just with the Northern Territory, there are other jurisdictions that we continually need to work with. But I have to say, I have reached out continuously with the Indigenous Affairs Ministers of each jurisdiction, and we do work reasonably well to try and work on these areas. But the Northern Territory specifically, I've reached out directly to the Chief Minister. I have raised directly the concerns around the incarceration rates, but also the deaths in custody that we've had in the last 12 months, really, in the Northern Territory in particular. So these are ongoing conversations that I have. I do push for that change, but it requires a whole-of-government approach, in particular from each state and territory jurisdiction to support me.
I mean, is it time that the Commonwealth puts more pressure on states like the Northern Territory and just says this is not good enough?
Well, that is the case. We have one of the areas that I am looking at, and I have spoken with my colleagues about, is the, and that's the Commonwealth colleagues, is about our relationships in federal funding. We have levers that we can pull, and I know that through the Northern Territory Remote Area Investment, the NTRA, that is certainly an agreement between the Commonwealth and the Northern Territory, where I have pushed for those levers to be looked at.
There's certainly criticism from Indigenous leaders that sometimes it feels like the states are just not pulling their weight with only 5 years left to meet these targets by 2031. What can actually change?
A lot of it is about a determination and a willingness. You know, we have to be willing to work together. I've done that in the Parliament in moving across every sector, whether it's the Liberals or the Nationals or the Greens or even One Nation and the crossbench. I've urged them to work with me. I have regular meetings with them to assist me in trying to close the gap, not just in my own caucus, but across the Parliament.
And just to make it really clear, you do feel like that there is a failure here of states to take this seriously?
No, I didn't say that. What I'm saying is that there are absolute challenges. I'm working directly with the Indigenous Affairs Ministers of each state and territory, and I appreciate that. What we have to do is actually be more willing to look at the legislative framework in each state and territory jurisdiction, for example, around incarceration, around reducing that. Let's look at the justice reinvestment that the Commonwealth is providing in places like Groote Eylandt, for example, where the local Anindilyakwa people are making sure that none of their young people are in the jails in Darwin. Why? Because they have the solutions to assist their people to stay out of prison and do the right thing.
Minister for Indigenous Australians, Malindiri McCarthy, thanks for your time this morning on AM.
Thank you, Isabella.
The US Attorney General has come under fire for her department's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files. Pam Bondi faced fierce criticism as she fronted a congressional hearing and accused Democrats of simply seeking a distraction. Our reporter Emily Grimenz was there in the room and filed this report from Capitol Hill.
On Capitol grounds blanketed in snow, survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse, like Danielle Bensky, made another stand.
The DOJ needs to do its job. Give us the rest of the files and start the investigations. Start the investigations on the things that are in the files right now.
Pam Bondi appeared before a congressional oversight hearing for the first time this year. In her opening statement, she defended the Trump administration's agenda and acknowledged the dozen or so Epstein survivors who were sitting in the hearing room.
I am deeply sorry for what any victim has been through, especially as a result of that monster. If you have any information to share with law enforcement about anyone who has hurt you or abused you, the FBI is waiting to hear from you.
Democrat Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal asked the survivors to stand before asking the Attorney General to turn and face them and apologise for the Justice Department's handling of this year's release. The exchange devolved into a shouting match.
Chairman, because she doesn't like the answer. Time. So,
Mr. Chairman,
why
I have asked
didn't she
question?
Ask Merrick Garland this? Twice.
I'm reclaiming my time,
my
and when I
will
reclaim my time,
to answer.
Mr. Chairman, the gentlelady has reclaimed her time.
I'm not going to get in the gutter for her theatrics.
The Justice Department's handling of the so-called Epstein files has repeatedly come under criticism. Today, Pam Bondi deflected questions by accusing Democrats of hypocrisy, asking why former governments didn't come under the same pressure. The Republican Congressman Thomas Massey pressured her over the files that mistakenly identified survivors and the redactions of alleged co-conspirators, another exchange that deteriorated.
Did you talk about Epstein?
I am reclaiming my time. I'm glad you're asking about Merrick Garland.
You don't get a reclaim
because
time
this
when
is
you
bigger
don't,
than
when
Watergate.
When I don't answer
this,
a question
this
the way you
goes
want.
Over four administrations. You don't have to go back to Biden. Let's go back to Obama. No. Let's go back to George Bush. This cover-up spans decades.
This is Emily Gremenz in Washington reporting for AM.
Antarctica is often regarded as the last pristine wilderness on the planet, but an Australian base that was shut down almost six decades ago is posing a major pollution threat to the delicate ecosystem, and there's still no timeframe or funding to complete the cleanup. Reporter Jano Gibson travelled there with the support of the Australian Antarctica Program.
On the coast of Australia's Antarctic Territory, Dr. Rebecca McWatters is checking rusting fuel drums at the Old Wilkes Station.
That's an example of a drum that's empty. It could mean it was always empty. It could also mean that it's released what was inside of it to the environment.
Dr. McWatters is the Environmental Remediation Lead at the Australian Antarctic Division.
It is pretty startling to come here and visit and see sites that are left behind. They're an enduring environmental problem.
Wilkes Station was built by the US Navy in 1957, before being handed over to Australia 2 years later. But it was abandoned after a decade of use.
So over here we have the stores and the kitchen, the galley and mess.
Back in the 60s, there was no requirement to clean up the station. Johan Metz is part of the Australian Antarctic Division's remediation team.
Actually, I can see condensed milk over there. And obviously in the 1960s, they was using this for their food. But today it's all rubbish for us.
But Dr. McWatters says it's what's buried under the ice in the station's waste dump that poses the biggest environmental risk. The snow-covered dump contains everything from rubbish and animal carcasses to batteries and thousands of old fuel barrels.
It's possible that anywhere there was a large fuel cache, there's still fuel present in those barrels.
Some of the fuel has already leaked into the soil. And as the climate warms, there's concern a major summer melt could expose the frozen fuel cache, allowing contaminants to leak into the surrounding waters. Claire Christian from the Antarctic and Southern Ocean Coalition says action needs to be taken before it's too late.
The issue especially is in Antarctica, it's hard to get to. So if something does happen, if there is an emergency, it's hard to clean it up.
Dr. McWatters says a comprehensive risk assessment funded by the federal government has been underway for several years.
We need to consider the activities we undertake, even with cleaning up, to make sure that we aren't going to make things worse during our remediation activities.
Back in 2014, the cost of cleaning up Wilkes and several smaller abandoned sites was estimated at $136 million. Until the current risk assessment is completed, the price tag of finally fixing Australia's toxic legacy in Antarctica remains unclear.
Jano Gibson with that report. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 6 years ago, ASIO was concerned. spy agency had the Bondi shooter, Naveed Akram, under investigation. So why did it determine back then that he didn't pose a serious threat? And was that an intelligence failure? Today, Sean Rubenstein Dunlop on his Four Corners investigation. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.